On the show today, the United Nations has released its annual report on the state of refugees in the world, and it's not good news.
The sharp rise in the number of people forced to flee their homes was driven by the war in Ukraine, revised estimates for Afghan refugees, and the outbreak of new conflicts, especially in Sudan.
Plus, as the Federal Reserve declines to act on interest rates in the United States, inflation is still ravaging Argentina.
There are 50 families, but bear in mind, each mother has 10 children, or 8, 7, 5. It became impossible to count the dishes you have to make for that amount of people.
And later, a look at the political situation in Pakistan since the arrest of former Prime Minister Imran Khan. Today is Thursday, June 15th, and this is VOA's International Edition. From VOA headquarters in downtown Washington, I'm Steve Karish. We start with a developing story from Greece, where at least 79 people are known to have died and hundreds more are missing after their overloaded boat capsized Wednesday and sank in the open waters of the Mediterranean Sea. The rescue and recovery operation stretched into the early hours of Thursday. The boat is said to have been only 20 to 30 meters long, however, it is believed to have been carrying around 750 people. Stories like this highlight the plight of migrants, refugees, and asylum seekers. In preparation for World Refugee Day, which is next week, the United Nations has released a report that found a record-breaking 110 million people around the world have been forcibly displaced from their homes. VOA's Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
Last year's record number of forcibly displaced people has been smashed by new figures showing that the fighting in Sudan has pushed the current global total to a staggering 110 million. The UNHCR reported Wednesday the sharp rise in the number of people forced to flee their homes was driven by the war in Ukraine, revised estimates for Afghan refugees, and the outbreak of new conflicts, especially in Sudan. UN High Commissioner for Refugees Filippo Grandi says the growing number of forcibly displaced is being met with greater hostility toward refugees around the world.
We see pushbacks, we see tougher and tougher immigration or refugee admission rules. We see in many countries a criminalization of immigrants and refugees, blaming them for everything that has happened and so forth.
The report finds refugees, people who cross an international border for security reasons, account for 35.3 million of the forcibly displaced. Most of the others are people displaced inside their home countries by conflict and violence. Grandi says, despite perceptions to the contrary, most displaced people around the world are hosted in low and middle-income countries.
I think the prevailing rhetoric is still that all the refugees go to the rich countries. This is actually wrong. It's quite the opposite. 70% of the refugees, meaning of those 35 million, actually flee to the country next to their country. Most of them actually want to go back home.
The report finds 52% of refugees and other people in need of international protection come from just three countries, Syria, Ukraine, and Afghanistan. With 3.6 million refugees, Turkey remains the largest refugee hosting country in the world. The Global Trends report says countries in sub-Saharan Africa host one in five of all refugees globally. The largest number, 4.7 million, were hosted in East Africa, the Horn of Africa, and the Great Lakes region. The Sudan conflict, which began in April, already has displaced close to 2 million people, with many of them crossing into neighboring nations. The report says 6 million refugees and internally displaced people returned to their countries and areas of origin in 2022. It notes the United States last year became the largest recipient of new individual asylum claims in the world, followed by Germany, Costa Rica, Spain, and Mexico. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The brutal fighting continues in Ukraine, as Ukrainian forces appear to have had limited success in the country's east. Odessa in the south was targeted by Russian missiles overnight. The AP's Charles Della Desma reports.
Russian forces have fired cruise missiles at the southern Ukrainian city of Odessa overnight, and shelling has destroyed homes in the eastern Donetsk region, killing some citizens and injuring many more. A Ukrainian military spokesman says Russia has stepped up aerial strikes in the 15-month war against Ukraine, just as the country's troops have reported limited gains at an early counter-offensive. In the east, Donetsk regional governor Pavlo Kirilenko has written on Telegraph, some people died after shelling destroyed seven homes and damaged dozens more in the cities of Kramatorsk and Konstantinovka. I'm Charles Della Desma.
And speaking of Russia's invasion of Ukraine, although others have tried and failed, six African leaders are heading to Moscow and Kyiv in the coming days to try to bring peace to the region. South Africa, which is leading the delegation, has been accused of favoring Russia despite its officially neutral stance on the war. Kate Bartlett reports from Johannesburg.
South African President Cyril Ramaphosa is leading the delegation, which also includes heads of state from Zambia, the Republic of Congo, Egypt, Senegal, and Uganda. The countries have taken different positions on the war, with South Africa, Uganda, and the Republic of Congo abstaining from a United Nations resolution earlier this year, condemning Russia's 2022 full-scale invasion and demanding it withdraw its troops. Zambia and Egypt voted in favor of the resolution, while Senegal didn't participate. Ramaphosa's spokesman, Vincent Magwenya, said the delegation's trip was imminent, although exact dates were not made public due to security concerns.
We are anticipating that quite imminently a delegation of African heads of states will head to both Ukraine and Russia.
South Africa has been criticized in the West for its warm relations with Moscow, having hosted Russian warships for joint military exercises earlier this year. And last month, the U.S. ambassador to South Africa accused the country of having provided arms to Russia. South Africa denies the charge that weapons were secretly loaded onto Russian vessel the Lady R while it was docked in Cape Town last year, but the controversy has strained relations with Washington. A group of U.S. lawmakers raised questions this week on whether South Africa should still be eligible for trade benefits, and top South African business leaders have also warned the country could pay economically for its stance, raising the possibility of sanctions. Stephen Groost, an analyst at the South African Institute for International Affairs, says it is hard to predict whether the six-leader mission will make a difference. With heavy fighting going on, he says the time is not ripe for negotiations, but adds that any attempt at peacemaking should be welcomed.
It might be a way to distract from the Lady R scandal about South Africa allegedly arming Russia on a ship that was loaded at night in secret, and the other flack that South Africa has been getting. But I do think it's coming from a genuine place of wanting to make a difference.
Russian President Vladimir Putin has welcomed the African leaders' mission, as has Ukraine. But in an online news conference last week, Ukrainian Foreign Minister Dmytro Kuleba warned that some things are non-negotiable.
Any peace initiative should respect the territorial integrity of Ukraine. It should not imply, even among in between the lines, any cessation of Ukrainian territory to Russia. Second, every peace plan should not lead to freezing of the conflict.
Ramaphosa is a seasoned negotiator, having been instrumental in talks that ended apartheid. But so far, peace plans proposed by other countries, including China, have failed, and critics are skeptical the African leaders' mission will achieve much. Meanwhile, the South African government is still mulling over what to do about the upcoming summit of the BRICS Group of Emerging Nations in Johannesburg, which Putin has been invited to attend. With a warrant from the International Criminal Court out against the Russian leader, South Africa would be obliged to arrest him, and there are reports the country is looking for a way out through a legislative amendment to their ICC agreement. South Africa has denied speculation it is considering moving the summit entirely. Kate Bartlett for VOA News, Johannesburg.
And here's a look at some of the other stories we're following from around the world. The UN Refugee Agency in Egypt appears to be having difficulties dealing with a large number of refugees, and Egyptian authorities have put a visa requirement on Sudanese refugees trying to enter the country. More than 100 people are dead after a boat capsized Monday night on the Niger River in northern Nigeria. From cleaning cow sheds to hitting fastballs, Dennis Kasumba is an 18-year-old from Uganda who is turning his American baseball dream into reality. And Pride Month in the United States includes a parade in Los Angeles that's one of the world's largest LGBTQ plus events. This year's celebrations come amid protests over school curricula and consumer boycotts of businesses marketing to the LGBTQ plus community. This is VOA News. It's VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Karish. A look at the political situation in Pakistan in the wake of Imran Khan's arrest coming up a little bit later in the show. First, though, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is heading to China later this week, a trip that was rescheduled from February after a suspected Chinese spy balloon flew through U.S. airspace. Expectations are low that Blinken's trip will be able to reset the two countries' relationship. VOA State Department Bureau Chief Nike Ching has the story.
A day before the U.S. military shot down a Chinese surveillance balloon, Secretary of State Antony Blinken postponed his meetings in Beijing, and U.S.-China ties hit a new low.
China's decision to fly a surveillance balloon over the continental United States is both unacceptable and irresponsible. That's what this is about. It's a violation of our sovereignty. It's a violation of international law.
After a few months, the top U.S. diplomat said it is essential for the two countries to maintain regular lines of communication.
It's clearly in the interest of both countries. Most dangerous thing is not to communicate, and as a result, to have a misunderstanding, a miscommunication.
The Pentagon also wants Beijing to answer a military hotline so generals can talk during incidents like last week's close encounter involving U.S. and Chinese ships in the Taiwan Strait. Observers say, despite the tensions, both governments are trying to set up a summit later this year, while Washington is seeking to re-engage Beijing on the issues of counter-narcotics and climate change. Congressional critics are skeptical the two countries can have a substantial change in the status of their relationship. Nike Chin, VOA News.
In economic news, the Federal Reserve left interest rates alone as it wrapped up its latest meeting. They're giving themselves time to look at demand for new loans and see if inflation has calmed down. AP correspondent Donna Warder reports.
It would be the first time in 15 months that policymakers not raise interest rates. Banks have been slowing their lending and demand for loans has fallen as interest rates have risen. Some analysts have expressed concern that the collapse of three large banks last spring could cause nervous lenders to sharply tighten their loan qualifications and worsen the drop in lending. Fed Chair Jerome Powell and other top policymakers have indicated that they want to assess how much a pullback in bank lending might be weakening the economy, but they say such a pause in raising rates may be brief, and another rate hike could come as soon as the Fed's next meeting in late July. Donna Warder, Washington.
One place inflation isn't under control is Argentina. Reuters' Emma Gell takes us there to meet a woman who manages a community kitchen in Buenos Aires, and she is overwhelmed by the demand.
Outside a market on the outskirts of Buenos Aires, people are rummaging through fruits and vegetables that have been thrown away to grab whatever is salvageable. It's where Anaí Robledo gets the food to run her community kitchen in a poor part of the city. She feeds 50 families every day, and she's struggling with the inflation that's been throwing more and more people into poverty.
Antes venían ponerle 15 familias, 10 familias, ¿no?
Some time ago, between 10 or 15 families used to come, and we cooked three times a week. Now, it's different. There are 50 families, but bear in mind, each mother has 10 children, or 8, 7, 5. it became impossible to count the dishes you have to make for that amount of people. Robledo, a domestic worker who volunteers on the side, says the soup kitchen simply can't keep up. It makes me sad because nothing changed. Nothing changed, but got worse. I'd like each family to have a plate of food on their table to eat with their children, so they didn't have the need to come to a soup kitchen to get food. Argentina is battling an economic crisis with inflation. It's estimated to hit around 150% by the end of the year, one of the highest rates in the world. Some 4 in every 10 people in the country have been left struggling in poverty.
That was Emma Gell of Reuters. Just over a month ago, nationwide protests broke out in Pakistan in the wake of the dramatic arrest of former Prime Minister Imran Khan, currently the country's most popular politician, according to surveys. In an unprecedented show of anger, protesters stormed military installations, ransacked the official residence of a top military commander, and vandalized monuments. Although calm has returned to Pakistan since then, the country's political landscape has shifted dramatically. Steve Miller speaks with VOA's Pakistan bureau chief, Sarah Zaman, in Islamabad to learn more.
Sarah, as I understand it, following the dramatic arrest of former Prime Minister Imran Khan, many of his former political allies have now formed their own political party. And I guess, what does that mean? And where is the former prime minister himself?
Yes. So even though the courts released Khan within a few days of his dramatic arrest, we saw that many members of his party, including very senior and prominent members of his party, quit the party in the following days. These are people who faced arrest. And in fact, many of them were arrested several times. As soon as the court would grant them bail in one case, they would get arrested under some other charges. And when these people eventually were released, we saw that they pretty much were reading from the same script. They would come out, they would hold these press conferences, they would condemn the events of the 2-3 days the violent protests that happened. They would condemn them. They particularly would condemn the vandalism of military installations. And then they would announce that they were quitting Khan's party. And then some of them even said that they were quitting politics altogether. And then a couple of weeks after that, we saw that many of these people, in fact, came together on the platform of a new party. And this new party is also spearheaded by a person who used to be a very close ally of Imran Khan's. This person helped the party financially. And so suddenly now he has appeared as this kingmaker, and this party has now emerged. We saw that Imran Khan has said that he's happy that so many of these people who were no good to his party have now finally left. So Khan has tried to sort of downplay this big loss that he has suffered. As far as Khan himself is concerned, he is nowhere to be seen in mainstream electronic media, because the narrative that has been built is that him and his party have taken part in something that was an attack on the state, and therefore somebody who has been a so-called enemy of the state should not be given any airtime. So while there hasn't been any order issued by government authorities saying Imran Khan should not be interviewed, the implicit order is that he is not to be interviewed.
Sarah, I want to turn our discussion to Pakistan's military, which is traditionally very strong in the country, not only having directly ruled for some 3 decades. How has the military responded in the weeks after the arrest?
The military has basically presented the protests, and especially the attack on military installations in particular, as an attack on Pakistan and as an attack on the military and as an attack on the sacrifices that the military has made in the last 20 years as it has tried to fight terrorism in Pakistan. And now, since these events, what we have seen on TV is constant pro-military messaging, and how the attacks of that day, May 9th and also on May 10th, were an attack on the state. So that is one thing that has happened. We have seen the military create a narrative in which it's trying to reconnect with the public and also trying to present the actions of the protesters as an attack on the state. We also know that military, some people are going to be tried in military courts for vandalizing and attacking military properties, military installations. The government has been defending that decision. The military has also defended that decision, and the military has, in fact, in a statement said that the claims of human rights abuses are just fake and they're false.
Sarah Zaman is VOA's Pakistan Bureau Chief, joining us from Islamabad. Sarah, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Steve.
That's VOA's Steve Miller speaking with VOA's Pakistan Bureau Chief, Sarah Zaman. And finally, today we go to Sweden, where activists have again targeted a painting in a museum to draw attention to climate change. The AP's Lisa Dwyer has that story.
Two women have been detained in Stockholm, Sweden, after they threw some kind of paint at a painting by French artist Claude Monet and then glued themselves to the frame. In a video made by Asha Stelvakmake, one activist can be heard shouting, "The situation is urgent." Another, that our health is under threat. A spokesperson for Sweden's National Museum says the artwork, the artist's garden at Gavarni, was encased in glass and is now being examined to see if any damage has occurred. The painting is the latest museum artwork that climate activists have targeted to draw attention to global warming. I'm Lisa Dwyer.
And that's going to do it for us today. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thanks for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, visit us online at voanews.com and follow VOA News on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. Until next time, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Stay safe and have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In coordination with the Republic of Korea, the United States is again targeting the malicious cyber activities of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, the DPRK. On May 23rd, the U.S. Treasury Department announced sanctions on four entities and one individual for hiding revenue and engaging in extensive illicit and IT worker operations to finance the regime's unlawful weapons of mass destruction and ballistic missile programs. According to a March 2023 U.N. panel of experts report cited by the Treasury Department, in 2022, DPRK cyber actors stole more virtual currency than in any previous year, with estimates ranging from $630 million to over $1 billion. To combat such activity, the United States designated Pyongyang University of Automation, one of the DPRK's premier cyber instruction institutions. Among its trainees are cyber actors who go on to work for cyber units tied to the Reconnaissance General Bureau, the RGB, the country's primary intelligence entity. Also designated was the RGB-controlled Technical Reconnaissance Bureau and its subordinate cyber unit, the 110th Research Center. The Technical Reconnaissance Bureau leads the DPRK's development of offensive cyber tactics and tools and operates several departments, including those affiliated with the U.S.-designated Lazarus Group, which was responsible for the largest virtual currency heist to date, stealing about $620 million in virtual currency. The United States, as well as the ROK, also designated the DPRK-based Chinyang Information Technology Corporation Company and one of its representatives, Kim Song-man, who operates in Vladivostok, Russia. Chinyang and Kim were sanctioned because of their connection to the DPRK's IT workers' activities. The DPRK generates significant revenue through deployment around the world of thousands of highly skilled IT workers who fraudulently obtain employment with companies. companies, including in the technology and virtual currency industries. The revenue generated by these workers contributes to the DPRK's unlawful WMD and ballistic missile programs. As Treasury Undersecretary for Terrorism and Financial Intelligence Brian Nelson wrote in a statement, the United States and its partners remain committed to combating the DPRK's illicit revenue generation activities and continued efforts to steal money from financial institutions, virtual currency exchanges, companies, and private individuals around the world.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.